This is Donette Thayer of Game Theory, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC, ICRA.
Hi, Laura Kuhn here, director of the John Cage Trust, bringing you a deep dive into the intriguing life and work of Renaissance man John Cage, celebrated composer, poet, philosopher, chess pupil of Marcel Duchamp, life partner of Merce Cunningham, macrobiotic chef, exponent of Zen, visual artist, and avid and pioneering mycologist. Tune in to All Things Cage, 7 p.m. Saturdays beginning January 2nd, for conversations with cage experts and enthusiasts from around the world, right here at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, and via the web at wavefarm.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Food New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Yo! Hold up! Time out! Time out! Y'all take a chill! You need to cool that shit out! And that's the double truth, Ruth!
Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening, I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, I have a conversation with Benjamin Morse. He's a Hebrew scholar, an art historian, a generally fantastic, interesting man. He's also the author of the Bible Beautiful series of illustrated children's books of Bible stories from the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. He originally got the idea of his books when his husband's friends in South Africa made them godparents to their daughter, who was Khosa. Benjamin was getting his PhD in Hebrew studies at the time and decided to make a book of Bible stories for her in which she could see herself, but without seeming like he was checking off boxes on a PC quota list. His solution was both beautiful and ingenious. So we talk about those books, and we talk about the wisdom traditions and Western thought a little bit, the Book of Job, one of my favorites, Christmas, and how the religious right has hijacked Christianity in the United States.
First, we start out talking a little bit about our terms. What are we talking about when we're talking about the Bible? And Benjamin shares a little bit of his journey into the world of Hebrew scholarship and how he got to be who he is. Benjamin Morse. When we're talking about the Bible, what are we talking about?
Well, you could be talking about it in two ways. I mean, and my background is in Hebrew Bible. That's what I did my PhD in. So when I said Bible for, 10 years, I was really referring to the Hebrew and Greek or Aramaic scriptures. So the Bible in general, I think most people nowadays would assume you're referring to the New Testament as well. So, and there's sort of differences in some of those collections, depending on whether you're Protestant or Catholic or Jewish. And, the Bible in general, it generally refers to the Old and New Testaments, but because Jews, I think, would normally refer to it as the Torah. So,
okay. And the Torah includes all the books in the Hebrew Bible.
Correct. Although the Torah itself, I mean, that's a wider term for the Torah, which is the quote unquote books of Moses, and then the writings and the prophets. So you would really call that whole thing the Tanakh, which is a kind of acronym for Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim.
Nevi'im, and what are those?
I'm sorry. Ketuvim is the writings, and Nevi'im is the prophets. So you would have Torah, prophets, and writings gets Tanakh. But usually when somebody's speaking of the Torah, they're referring to the whole collection of the books.
But you yourself were not raised in the Jewish faith.
No, I was, my parents were actually both raised Lutheran, but converted to, well, they joined the Episcopal Church, when I was about 18 months old. So, I really grew up in the Episcopal Church, and my mother ended up attending seminary. You know, she was in the first sort of generation of women who were able to be ordained. And she had always grown up with a passion for the Old Testament as she knew it. And, you know, as an undergraduate in college, wanted to be a religion major. And this was, you know, a women's college in the early 60s. And my grandparents said that, well, a woman majoring in religion, that's silly. Why would you do that? You can't do anything with that. So she was an English major. And the years went on and, you know, suddenly they were ordaining women. So she went to seminary and just really excelled in her Hebrew and Old Testament studies. And her professors at Virginia Theological Seminary said, you know, you really have a gift for this. You should go on and teach. And they were anticipating a shift in faculty in the years to come. And so they said, you know, you go on and get your PhD and we'll probably have a place for you here when you're done. So she actually, she did do a PhD in the Old Testament. She finished, she died actually just before she finished her dissertation. And so, you know, as a priest, you know, she never practiced very much as a parish priest because she was in academia. But, you know, for her preaching, you know, in an Episcopal service, at least you hear an Old Testament lesson, a psalm, which is also Old Testament, and then a gospel and maybe a letter, an epistle. And, you know, she was very passionate about making sure her sermon covered all of those readings because as modern listeners, you know, we don't know what these things mean. They sound so weird. And the tendency is for preachers to get up there and just talk about the gospel. They think that's why they're there to preach. So I grew up with this predisposition towards valuing and listening to the Hebrew scriptures. And, you know, we always found the stories more entertaining on one level. And my sister and I knew all the lyrics to Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. So, you know, when I went off to college, I actually ended up, you know, in my second year, I, you know, took a Jewish traditions class. And I remember, first of all, the teacher was so hardcore. I mean, talk about understanding what it means when they say you're here to learn critical thinking skills. Everything somebody said, she would flip it on its head and make you, you know, see the opposite, you know, could also be true. And I wanted nothing more than to please her and to get an A in her class. And so I really worked my butt off in that class. And, you know, I just thought Midrash and Talmud were so great. I loved this understanding that Judaism itself was a changing, evolving, you know, a way of thinking, and that you had to constantly reinterpret these ancient texts. And it got me thinking about Christianity. And I just came to this belief that, well, I think Jesus was trying to reform Judaism, and make it again, bring it back to, you know, what we hear in Deuteronomy and what the prophets were saying. You know, this is something that's written on your heart. You have to believe these things and act according to something more than just a transactional gesture of, like, you know, paying for your sacrifice, for instance. And the prophets were all about social justice, looking after the orphan and the widow. So I just felt like that's what Jesus was trying to get the people of his time back to, those fundamental roots of Judaism, and open it up to the rest of the world, open it up to Gentiles. So I ended up majoring in Judaism, you could say. I was a religion major, but my thesis was on Israeli art. And I've often said I kind of wanted to be Jewish. And I mean, and that was earlier as a kid, I was sort of fascinated
by... Well, now you can be.
Well...
Yeah.
And in fact, my senior year of college, I talked to my supervisor, who was this Orthodox guy, and I said, you know, I think I might want to convert. And he said, well, you know, maybe you should try to stick with what you were raised at. See if you can work it out, you know, and give it till you're 30. And I'm really glad he said that, because I think as a young person suddenly rushing off into a new faith, it can be a bit, you know, premature. And I've just been on this kind of long journey, and wow, I mean, now I'm at the stage where I can barely define what I think God is, but I know it's something. And I think these ancient scriptures reveal so much, not just about whatever that thing is, but just the fact that people have been grappling with it for thousands of years. And I'm super into the wisdom literature, Ecclesiastes. You just never know it was the Bible if you just read it on its own.
What do you mean? How do you mean you would never know it was the Bible?
It never mentions the word God. In my PhD dissertation, I do this comparison. I say the speaker is like a dandy conducting a salon. And he's got all these speakers around him, and he's pretending to be this aristocrat, which was what the dandy's position was. And he's sort of circulating a bunch of ideas, and there's no systematic theology, you know, that can be written out on it. I mean, he's there are different structures to it, but it's very free flowing and very modern. It's, you know, like, well, there's nothing new under the sun, guys. You know, he keeps saying that. And he says, you know, it's all, you know, we're all going to die. It's all just a bunch of wind, but, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, you know, go on with it and be rich if you can, you know, cause you're going to lose it all. It's wonderfully, I guess you could say existential. But it's, you know, it's not, a pious tract.
Huh. Be rich if you can, because you're going to lose it all. That's interesting. That seems to fly in the face of what Jesus said later, right? So look, while we're on it, let's talk a little bit. I mean, if you know the milieu in which Jesus lived, kind of relative to the Jewish wisdom tradition, like, what was the Jewish wisdom tradition, and to what degree do his preserved sayings reflect wisdom tradition modes of teaching?
Wow, that's a very sophisticated question, and one that I haven't really thought about. I don't know that. I mean, you know, when we look at the New Testament books, there's an influence of Greek philosophy in there. When it comes specifically to the sayings of Jesus, you know, I've always thought of him more as a kind of rabbinic thinker. And as I mentioned earlier, he's really concerned about the essence of the prophets and doing justice. And then there is also this eschatological sense of, you know, the end of time and what happens after this life. So those are more prophetic concerns. And in terms of, you know, wisdom literature, you know, wisdom is such a broad thing. You have Proverbs, which are very, you know, simple. God, I can't even quote one off the top of my head, but I mean, they're, it's very kind of household oriented. And then you have Ecclesiastes, or this preacher Kohelet, who's sort of throwing all these ideas around. And then you have the book of Job, which is this total whirlwind, if I may make a pun, because God appears as the whirlwind in the end. And it's this whole grappling with whether or not there's such a thing as just desserts. You know, do you get what you deserve? And I mean, the whole book is a big, wow, should I say this? It's almost like a middle finger to heaven. You know, like, Job has done nothing wrong. And all of his friends are going, oh, no, you must have. And in the end, you know, God basically says, hey, where were you when I created the universe? But he also says, you know, the friends were wrong. And Job takes back what he said. And then he's given all this blessing. But it's just a constant debate about the nature of justice and whether life is fair. So wisdom to me.
What does that mean? What does fair mean?
Well,
I mean, as a teacher of of adolescence, I hear that a lot. Mm. You know, like, that's not fair. And it's like, when you say it's not fair, I think you're really saying you don't want to do what I'm asking you to do.
Well, and I think Job, I mean, actually, I did my master's thesis on Job.
Yeah, let's
and
talk,
I mean,
oh,
I my approach to it was that you have to approach it from multiple angles, and you can't just read it from any single direction. And so my metaphor that I used for that was a polymorphic painting by the Israeli artist Yaakov Agam. He created these corrugated surfaces, and one of them is actually in, it's on the north end of Grand Central in that MetLife building. Mm-hmm. So it's a corrugated surface, and he would paint one series of geometric shapes on the panels facing the left, and another set of shapes and colors on the panels facing right, so that you could never see the entire image from one vantage point. You had to walk around it. And so it was the totality of all those vantage points that gave you truth. And so that's how I say you have to look at the book of Job. You can't just read it, you know, for the simple ending. You can't just read it as, you know, like some game God has played with Job, letting the Satan, you know, challenge him. You can't just read it from the vantage point of the friends who are supposedly comforting him. You know, you have to take so many things in consideration. And ultimately, I think that there's not an answer for Job, which is what Jung wrote a book called. But, you know, ultimately, like it is saying life isn't fair.
Mm.
And sometimes you're going to get, sometimes you're going to get blessed with double, whether you, did the right thing or not. And sometimes you're going to end up, you know, losing everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you have absolutely no control over it.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Job, it always struck me. I mean, I read it in high school. I had, for AP English, I just made me really angry as an adolescent because there was no sense of fairness or justice as I could comprehend at that time. And it seems so capricious the way it opens. God and Satan kind of like make a bet, you know?
Yeah.
Like Satan sort of eggs him on and he takes the bait. You know, and it was like, this is not how I didn't have a religious upbringing, but that was what do you make of that? Or you mentioned that
so,
as a particular lens.
Well, so Job is considered an allegory of Israel's experience in exile. So there is this sense that, you know, Israel had to go through this because they ignored the prophets for so many, you know, cycles of kings. And, you know, first of all, they chose a king in the first place. And Samuel said, why would you do this? Like, you already have an earthly, you have God as your king. Why do you need an earthly king? So, you know, for however many 100 or 200 something other years, don't quote me, you know, they kept having these disasters with kings, right? And that led to the Babylonian exile because they had done it the wrong way and they kept, not following the laws. So at the end of it, you know, God has said, okay, you've served your time. Now I'm going to send you back. And that's what the whole blessing is about, is that now you can go back to the homeland and start living again. So, you know, in terms of the injustice, I think the beautiful answer that's in the book is this incredible vision that God gives of everything he/it can see. And it goes from the tremendous to the minute and particular, you know, like the baby animals and all these things on the corner of mountaintops.
It was like a Terrence Malick film. Yeah.
Right. And it also gives you, however, there is still this, this Leviathan, and this behemoth, these chaos creatures. Like, so God is acknowledging there is still chaos and it's kind of kept at bay, but that thing could bubble up at any time. So I think it's kind of an admission, whether it's on the biblical writer's parts or if you want to think about it in terms of God's own admission, that, you know, he's not controlling everything. And this is a kind of antidote to, I think, the quite simplistic attitude that, well, this whole idea that God is omnipotent and controls everything. I mean, I think that's when we get confused. How did God let this happen? It's like, well, because God isn't making everything happen. That to me is a very anthropocentric, you know, human-centered way of looking at it, versus what this whole vision God gives is in the whole book of Job, I think, asks us to have a theocentric, like, well, it might not all make sense here, but look up there, look outside yourself, look at and understand that there's something that sees everything, and it's not going to like put all the pieces in place for you and make life easy, but it'll be there at some level to wow you, right?
So that, I mean, that in a sense is the answer to the Epicurus's paradox. God is good, omnipotent, and omniscient. And then when, you know, why is there evil in the world?
Right. Right.
If God is omnipotent and he allows evil, then he's not good, right? If God is doesn't know about the evil, then he's not omniscient. And if he's not, and if he knows about it and does nothing.
Right. And I think that the whole setup with him making a deal with the Satan or the adversary, like that he, it's like, again, like people made this up, right? I just don't think we're being asked as people, like there wasn't really a Job, right? I mean, it's an allegory. It's a made up thing. It's like, this is how we're going to deal with this, is to write this story in this debate with a so-called happy ending, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, historically speaking, is Job considered to be the product of a single author, or?
I mean, I think there's always more than one hand in any given biblical text, right. But I'm pretty sure it's considered to be by a single author. I mean, although there's many things that, you know, resonate with other scriptures. I mean, there's bits of Isaiah and there's Psalms and everything. So, but I think it's pretty, and written at the end of the exile or around then. I guess I should clarify, maybe not a single author, but a single school, like a kind of group of people who were together writing this thing. But I think this is the wonderful thing about all these multiple hands at work, and the ancients left it that way. They didn't have to iron it all out. There could be more than one day count to the flood. You know, there could be two competing creation stories. And that to me is, it's again, it's a something of wonder. And it's like, they could see that everything didn't fit together and make sense. And it's only, in my view, like, you know, the Enlightenment, you know, this age of reason comes in when people started like working out these really weird kind of mental gymnastics to explain why there's a 40-day and a 100-day or 150-day flood count, like mixed, intertwined together. Well, it's because there were two different traditions. And at some point they're like, well, we have to satisfy the people in the North and the South, so we're going to just weave them into one story. And
right. Well, and up until the Enlightenment, did people not have these questions? Did they not need to reconcile them, or they were just content to let these completely different accounts exist side by side?
I think, I think for, you know, your average lay person, no,
sorry,
I thought we were going to talk about a children's Bible here, but I think that,
no, we'll get there in a second.
I think that your average lay person, you know, wasn't necessarily reading all this directly and understanding the contradictions. I think biblical scholars, you know, before the Enlightenment, I think there was a kind of sense of the of how ancient and how far away the biblical writer's mind was. So if there were contradictions, maybe they would come up with some reason for it. But I think there was also a sense that, well, it was back then. You know, they had a different understanding of things. So it didn't have to be what we now call systematic.
Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot, a has laid poor Jesus in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same. Sell all of your jewelry and give it to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus come to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Now the working people followed him around, sang and shouted gay. But the cops and the soldiers nailed him in the air, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave.
This is Foraging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor. And in my next segment with Benjamin Morse, Hebrew scholar, art historian, and author of the Bible Beautiful series of illustrated children's books, we discuss how he came to write the Bible Beautiful series, the purpose of those books, and a little bit about Christmas and how the religious right has hijacked Christianity in the United States. Benjamin Morse. Describe the books and explain a little bit about why you felt the need to write them.
Sure. So the two books are, it's called the Bible Beautiful series, and it began, I can't count how many years ago, but I was asked to be the godfather to a girl in South Africa. My partner's sister adopted a girl, the family is South African, and she is Xhosa, and I'm white. And I thought, well, the family actually goes to church. Here's an opportunity to get a godchild, a present that actually has to do with God rather than just, you know, go to Baby Gap and get it a pair of overalls. I'd always made my own Christmas cards and things, you know, through collage, and I was doing a PhD in Hebrew Bible at the time. So I thought, why don't I just make her an illustrated Bible? So the first thing I had to deal with was, well, how am I going to represent the figures given that, you know, we are racially different? And if I try to do some kind of quota thing on the page, I mean, that kid's going to go, oh God, my white godfather decided, you know, he would have one black person, one Asian, like whatever the headcount needed to be. So I just thought, well, actually, all of this, I mean, it's, you know, we're never going to know what these people look like. And I looked at the children's Bibles out on the shelves and I just thought, they're just quite saccharine, I feel. And there's the little polka dot eyes, everything's very cutesy. And they're either just like three stories, not even attempted to string them together. They get creation, they get Noah and the Ark, and then they maybe do Daniel. Or it's so dense that no child's ever going to read it. But the illustrations themselves, I just didn't feel like they were really communicating to contemporary children's eyes. I mean, they've done cartoon versions and this and that, but again, just nothing that was going to really illuminate these stories for them. So I thought, well, wait a minute. What about doing the figures in silhouette so that I'm not putting little eyes and smileys on them? And also I can use brown craft paper and then make them in such a way that anybody of any ethnicity can read them and see themselves in them. And what I soon found out was that Rudolf Steiner had actually designed dolls that didn't have faces with the idea that a child can bond better by kind of projecting their own face onto that doll. So from the beginning, and I said, I want this to be something that Setu can read and identify with. And as I was making it, I thought, well, God, here's a way, maybe I could, you know, make a real version of this and publish it. So my tagline for the first published edition, which was the oldest bedtime story ever, how I got around calling it, not having to choose between Old Testament and Torah, was by calling it the oldest bedtime story ever. And the tagline is for people of all ages, colors, and creeds. Because I thought it was important. You know, these stories are shared by multiple faith traditions, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And, you know, why can't, wouldn't it be a beautiful thing, you know, if all kids could read this, or all Abrahamic descendants, so to speak. And I just thought, you know, why is there, you know, they have the Catholic Children's Bible, they have this one, like, well, what about something that everybody, because we should be unified in this, right? We should not be dividing. So that was published.
Well, a house divided against itself, somebody once said.
Right. So that was published in 2012, and, you know, got some very nice reviews, and actually independently it sold pretty well. And I always intended that I would do a New Testament, which I end the oldest bedtime story ever by saying it is to be continued. Because for Christians, there's a New Testament, but for Jews, I just raise it that, you know, the story continues because Israel carries on, you know? And so the New Testament
the Messiah is yet to come. So when
correct, yeah,
when the Messiah for Israel comes, you could do another book.
Correct. Yeah. So, and I tried not to make too much emphasis on the Messiah at the end of the Torah, because it's like, it's actually not that big of a deal for Jews, as far as I understand. Like, it's a big deal for Christians, but like, I don't know too many Jews who are hung up on like, when is the Messiah coming, you know? So, anyway, so I made this New Testament. Now the Old Testament or Torah, I did on a black paper background. And so all these silhouette figures kind of pop, and it's sort of, the idea is that it's kind of like a cosmic space. It's sort of imaginative. And with the New Testament, I guess I had this idea that it would sort of be like stepping into Oz. So I made all the pages are a different color. And so that created huge problems when I went to print, because the printers did not match the proofs, and they had to reprint from scratch. But, you know, with the New Testament, it was interesting, even though it's so much shorter, it was a much greater challenge to write that narrative. Number one, because you have four gospels that are all telling basically the same story, but there are a lot of discrepancies. You know, were there 5,000 or 2,000 fish? Was it a Sermon on the Mount or a Sermon on the Plain? Like one, you know, one person saying it this way and the other saying it the other way. So I had to kind of come up with a single narrative that strung some of those together. And then also, you know, the Acts of Apostles, I mean, that's actually pretty straightforward to, it's, you know, it's a single chronology, but then what, all the letters, I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're reflective. They're not really stories about people. So I had to figure out how I was going to get as much of the epistles in there as I could. And then the fun part was Revelation. How do you make that cute for kids? But I think my four horsemen, I pull it off.
How do you make the Revelation cute for children? Right.
I think I did it. I don't know.
That will keep you up for days.
Yeah. Yes. My little angel, Archangel Michael, killing, slaying the beast and everything. I think he's pretty sweet. He's a little gay. He's got pink trousers on.
Archangel Michael has pink trousers on as he's slaying the beast.
And he's not the most manly command of the sword, but he's killed that beast. So
does the beast have a blonde comb over?
Oh, it's I would call it more of an orange comb over. If you look at the beast, it's outlined in orange, and it does maybe have a comb over. And that's because in those apocalyptic texts, these beasts in Daniel and Revelation, they were about living world rulers who are going to come to power and bring about this ultimate apocalypse. So it's not, I mean, I guess I won't name names, but, you know, it's not out of context to look at certain world leaders and go, well, they're bringing about the end of time. Just the beast.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. You obviously couldn't do all of the stories. And again, as I was reading the New Testament, it occurred to me, I know these stories. Like, I've never read them before, right? But these, our culture, our literature, everything is so steeped in them that as just a man living in the West, I know all of these stories. And I thought, wow, that's like, there was nothing completely shocking I didn't know that, you know, that I was reading. And how did you choose, like, what was your editorial process? Like, I'm going to do this one. I'm not going to do that one.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying that, you know, about the stories being familiar. And number one, I wanted to make this as much of a reference tool for adults and, you know, non-Christians, and some of my atheist friends have been like, this is so useful because, like, I can just go to the kind of condensed version of what this is and I understand where it fits into the wider narrative. So I really do mean that it's for all ages, colors, and creeds. How did I choose? I mean, honestly, some of it, you look at the page count. Okay, I knew I had a certain 76 pages. I knew I needed at least 2 pages at the end for the end of book material. I have little chapter references and things there. And I just thought, you know, because I want to fit in Revelation, you can't do that in 2 pages. Even you have at least 4 for that one. And how do I handle, you know, the letters of Paul, the Acts? I mean, you just start and then how many pages for the crucifixion, right? I mean, I just had to sort of, start blocking it out, you know, storyboarding. And so, you know, I think I could have spent more time on, you know, the birth narrative and Bethlehem, but, you know, you only have so many pages. So when it comes to other things, I think, you know, there's a page with the Good Samaritan and the centurion servant. I wanted to draw out stories that were about this whole principle of loving your neighbor and also, you know, stop judging other people. And stories like the centurion servant, you know, the average reader might not catch it, but, you know, in the Gospel of Mark, I believe, which is, you know, not by far, but the oldest gospel, it is a centurion and his servant. And what was controversial about Jesus blessing them was that that was considered a sexual relationship. So God is saying, you know, bless these people. And people would look at that and say, oh, the Pharisees didn't like it. They're blessing him because he's Roman and the Romans are our enemies. But really the scandal is that it was a gay couple. And so.
Wait, back up. How do we get to that?
How do we get to that? Because the word that Mark uses, begins with a P. It's a Greek word. I mean, it's for a servant. It's the Roman servant. Historically, we know that relationship was more than just somebody polishing your shoes. It was a sexual. it was like the Roman, the older male was training the younger servant as his lover.
True. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So then, what happens? The other two gospels that mention this, they change the relationship from servant to son. So that the scandal for the Pharisees in this, again, it goes back to, oh, it's a Roman. Why is Jesus blessing a Roman? He's not like us. But so I, you know, call him the servant as a sort of like very, almost parenthetically, like, and their gesture is one, you know, the servant boy has, listen, he has pink sleeves. He's touching his master's face, you know, it's a very loving embrace. And then below it, you know, we have the Samaritan. It's a similar thing that you know, the people didn't want, the Samaritans were the descendants of the people who had stayed behind in the land of Israel when the others went to, into exile. And they became kind of second-class citizens when the people came back from Babylon. And so they were no longer really considered real Jews. And so the scandal here is that, oh, this Samaritan is the good guy? What are you talking about? And so Jesus is always like, or often, like making these strangers, these no-name people, the ones that he blesses. And that's what I think is very key for a lot of Christians in this day and age to remember, because there's a lot of, you know, acts of exclusion and demonization that happens that is fundamentally the opposite of what Jesus was teaching.
But the centurion, what I thought was interesting about the centurion was that the centurion himself did not invite Jesus into the house. Like he said, no, you just stay outside, because he knew that for Jesus to come into the house of a Gentile, house of a Gentile would be unclean.
Mm.
And he didn't want Jesus to stoop to that. He didn't want to make Jesus eat. At least that's how it's presented in Luke. And I was like, oh, that was really in addition to sort of allowing Jesus to demonstrate his, distance healing, which sort of, I guess, foresaw telemedicine.
Interesting. Well, it's also, if you think about what I was saying, the centurion wouldn't necessarily have had shame in having this servant lover, but he might have recognized that Jesus is a Jew. So he didn't want Jesus to be defiled in any way by going against his religion.
It sounds to me like, and you've mentioned this, that in addition to sort of making this for all people, all children and adults and of any race, religion, creed, sexuality, as a response to sort of the right wing interpretations of the Gospels that we're getting today.
Yeah, and I don't even know if you can call them interpretations. They're sometimes so motivated by their own political and ideological fury. This weird demonization of foreigners that has no place in Christian theology. And Jesus said, I was a stranger and you let me in. You can just pluck any verse out there. So I don't know where these people come up with it. But this other thing that I find so disturbing and antithetical, once again, to the Gospels is this whole, they call it the gospel of prosperity. There's people like Joyce Myers, I think her name is. She's has a huge following on one of these mega churches receive however many million. And she's always saying, they're always saying, the Lord wants you to be successful. It's like, could you quote where that comes? I don't know where, we'll bless you with abundance and all that kind of, I guess so. But Jesus wants you to have a successful career? Where do you get that? It's just bizarre. And I have relatives who mean well. And they help the poor, but you mentioned the word socialism, and we were not supposed to apply political words to, religion. But if Jesus had to fit into a political party, he would be a socialist. It's just
more than that. He'd be intolerable. You have two cloaks. Give one cloak away. This guy said he's really concerned about getting into the kingdom of heaven. And he says, look, I've lived an exemplary life, and Jesus said, you have, you've kept the laws and all these, you're a righteous man. And he says, well, what do I need to do to get in? And he's like, okay, all that's left for you is to give away all your stuff. And the guy's like, ooh, I don't know about that. How do you get from there to, like you said, the gospel of prosperity?
How do they they grow up in extreme capitalism, believing that the word socialism is, equal to the devil, and people will use religion to justify anything. So, I don't have, a whole list of how, the moral majority and the conversion of the Republican Party turned into this weird extreme group. But, cherry picking is how people do it. They'll find one little verse about abundance or something and turn that into suddenly we're all meant to just make as much money as we can. And, you're on your own if you didn't work hard enough. No, they just plug, they just insert that, right? I think the other point is that's very relevant today is that, I make a point of at the crucifixion, pointing out, he died between two criminals. And, you know, I've had some personal experiences over the years where I just thought, you know, look at the way the difficult thing about Christianity is that we have to forgive everyone. And it's not just, oh, my enemy and they live over there, but like, you know, the demons, like the murderers, the rapists, the pedophiles, like there's, you've gotta somehow be able to have compassion for them and understand that even though they may not, you know, they may not repent even, or look at all apologetic, like there is a human being inside everybody. And we are meant to empathize somehow with everyone. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but I've had certain experiences with people where I felt like I was the last one willing to like hold that person's hand when the rest, no, you can't forgive that. You can't forgive that. And it's just like, well, you know, so this whole business of Jesus dying between two criminals, I just thought, you know, well, God is there. God is there with the most like extreme outcasts. And that's what Christianity teaches me. So, you know, being moralistic and pointing fingers and, you know, I mean, it's a huge tragedy what, you know, the criminal justice system in America. And that's just another area where I don't understand how certain evangelicals, like what gospels are they reading? I don't understand sometimes.
So let's, because it's the season, even though this is going to be airing after, what struck me again reading the New Testament for the first time was just how little time was devoted towards the birth of Jesus. How did you deal with that in your book, and what decisions did you make in sort of presenting that story? What to you is important about that story?
Well, they're all, each gospel is different. I mean, John doesn't even really mention it, right? I mean, it's just, it's like, it's, and each one, like Matthew tells this part of it, Luke tells that part of it. I wanted to, in the text, to say, you know, Matthew says that so-and-so, you know, this happened, and then John said, but I just thought that's too much, like, on, you know, quite sparsely written pages. So you
put them together.
Yeah, I put them together, and I thought I should open it with, you know, set it in the time of Augustus, and that there was this feeling of misery and strife. And so people were calling out for help. And so God sent this angel. And then we have, you know, I wanted to present Mary, you know, at the Annunciation, rather than being this young girl on her knees praying with the angel talking to her. I wanted her to be freaked out that she's pregnant. Right. So I have her. She's got these kind of,
which is probably true.
It doesn't say she wasn't. And also, I mean, one of the gospels does say that Joseph was shocked. He's like, wait a minute, what? You know, because I mean, he understands that he wasn't her father.
Joseph was going to, it was in Matthew.
Yeah.
He was looking at, he was going to get a get.
Right. Yeah.
Like he was like, look, it's cool, whatever, you know, I'm going to go. And then an angel actually had to come to Joseph and talk him down.
Right.
Like, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. So my illustration of the Annunciation, it's Mary, and she's kind of got these pigtails, and she's got her hands to her head, you know, freaking out in the dress. It's actually a picture of a Pucci scarf. That's quite psychedelic. So it's like expresses, it's like, it's like the scream. I just think it's more relatable than, oh, she just accepted it. Handmaid of the Lord. Thank you.
You got to get a little more pizzazz with the,
And then, you know, and then when it gets to, you know, the angels and the shepherds, if you notice, if you look at my angels singing in the sky, like it's basically a gospel choir. I mean, there's one woman's got dreads, and you know, they're getting down, you know. I just wanted it to be, I wanted to make it fun and not like all the versions you've ever seen before. There's often like little sheep making little funny gestures, and with the gifts from the kings, I did a little branding. We've got King's Quality Gold, Baby's Rattle, Finest Fabulous Frankincense, and Myrrh of Arabia, Distinctive Aroma, Heals Wounds.
Well, and that's funny. What? But the story itself is so significant.
Mm-hmm.
And that always bothered me, like, if they're going back to Galilee, right, Nazareth,
or no, going, sorry, to Bethlehem, yeah,
right. If they're going to Bethlehem, which is where Joseph's from, right? And he doesn't have any relatives there, you know, like, oh, you come stay with us,
right?
Like, I never understood, other than, you know, fulfilling the prophecy of the Messiah being born
in the house of David,
in the house of David, what is that story, how does that story speak to the modern audience?
Well, two things. You know, historically, I think that has to do with, you know, for the census, you had to go back to where your clan was based. And so I think, you know, we can look at this as Joseph was however many generations removed from ever having lived in Bethlehem. So he's just going back to some place that isn't home, but for the sake of the Romans, he's got to show up.
Oh.
I think for modern, you know, readers in this day and age, it's an image of refugees, or it becomes refugees when they have to go to Egypt. But, you know, here they are on the road and homeless. And I think that's hugely important that, you know, this, the one that God sent to save us had no home to sleep in the night he was born. I mean, let's remember that, people. We should always be giving people homes to live in, right? So I think those are some, you know, quite simple and straightforward ways to think about this for modern readers. When it comes to the temptation, you know, I have this, it's from marbled paper, and I cut it all together to look like a big swirl coming down from the sky. And so the devil is like this, almost this circus figure. And he's juggling the stones to turn into bread he's like juggling them. And, cause I just thought, you know, in the movie versions we've seen of this, the devil is always this scary gray monster with a worm coming out of its nose. And I just thought, I always was confused. I'm like, how is that tempting? Like, I would run away from that. Like, that's right. Not tempting. The right. point about right. the devil and temptation right. is that, like, it's seductive and you want to do it. And so that's why I made him like this fun, colorful, kind of almost joyful creature coming down. And Jesus is very dramatically, like, covering his eyes and moving in the opposite direction. Like, he will not, you know, succumb to the trick and turn the stones into bread. And I've got a page, the page that faces that is them, you know, debating scripture. And this is when I kind of realized that I was taking the artwork up to another level, because all of these characters have like multiple accessories and trimmings. We've got python trimming and purple fur and a lorgnette and everything. There were certain pages where I thought you could get so OCD, you've got to stop. Another page is, it's when the Pharisees are, debating the purpose of the law, and he's giving out grain on Sabbath and healing people. And, I've got a picture of him, and there's a guy on the ground with his arm in a sling, and and Jesus is sort of blessing him. And then next to him is a woman in red with sort of like white frilly bits coming out of her, little top. And she's got she looks like sort of like a saloon lady. So she's my sexy sinner. So it's my little subtle way for kids to see that sexy ladies are loved by God too. Let's see. There's little nods to modern art in both volumes. The Sadducees are shown in a row. They're very rigid, and their forms are, they're kind of echoing Malevich. suprematist images. Let's see, what else? I think there was something I wanted to. And some of these, you know, the women mourning Jesus, they're all wearing little cuttings from Vogue magazine. what else? Here's another political page. Sorry. There's a bit when this is in the Acts of the Apostles, and Stephen is stoned to death. He's the first martyr to die for his faith in Jesus. Now, okay, like, how do you present someone being stoned to death in a kid's Bible? Well, I mean, I did it. I mean, it's, you know, it's not too gruesome, I think. But a little subtle visual thing going on here is that Stephen the Christian is wearing this kind of, it's kind of a onesie, like a rower's singlet. But the pattern of it is actually Islamic. And then the man who is stoning him has this silvery, almost like a breastplate. And if you look in closely enough, you see that they're crosses. So my little subtle thing is, well, who's the martyr now? You know, and it's a little question mark to my people. And then on the next page, the next double page spread. So Paul, at first he was Saul, and he's a Jewish policeman. And he, you know, was sort of looking for Christians and sending them to prison. So, and this is before Jesus visits him on the road to Damascus and asks him, why do you persecute me? So the vision for, the image of Paul being a policeman is a kind of, it's a, like a police badge, and it says Holy Order Squad Home Invasion Agent, which is like an ICE agent.
Sure.
So there's all those little things. I mean, I haven't seen anyone call any of this out and, you know, say this is scandalous, but I hope it will be.
Well, as you said, it's subtle, and we don't do subtle very well in this country.
If I can make a joke, you're welcome to edit this out. But I've often said, I think what I should do to make it sell is release a sex tape and then really repent. So that, you know, because that'll get people's attention. But if, you know, yeah.
Right. Author of children's Bible. Right? So, right.
I think the last thing, I think this is changing tune here. The last thing, you know, I made this one, you know, my approach to this was much more methodical than the Torah. You know, I really blocked it out from the beginning, and I started with,
which, to be honest, actually kind of reflects how both of those books came into being.
Yeah, on a level, yeah. But I just, it was a good exercise to just do one page at a time in order, and it was also wonderful to like put them up on my wall and watch it, you know, just start covering the whole thing. And on the last page, you know, it says, and this is how the glory of the Lord and the Spirit of heaven come to life on earth every day. And so I just cut out to close it. I cut out the letters and put them on different pattern papers. I cut out the words Jesus saves. And I remember sharing that, like texting a friend, look, I just finished my book and this is the last page. And he asked me, he said, do you believe that? And I had to sort of fumble. I mean, I think it's a kind of Episcopalian thing in general, and it's just also personal for me, but I'm really shy about what I believe in. And even to say the words Jesus saves, that sounds a little bit too, you know, far right, or like I'm imposing something on someone, or like I don't have an intellectual bone in my body. I think there's this weird assumption that if somebody says they believe in God, that they're somehow not intellectual. Whereas I think that actually faith is incredibly complicated and full of blank spaces, and you can't answer everything. But in terms of the whole Jesus saves thing, I would tell people this story, and one friend of mine, she said, no, wait a minute, Jesus was a rabbi, and rabbis teach people, and education saves, so Jesus saves. And I went, oh, okay, I can do that one.